And thank you again to everybody who's read. It's helped us open the meeting. Like you said, this is a speaker meeting. The format of that is that we're going to have a speaker who's going to come in, who's going to share with us for 40, 45 minutes their journey to, into, and through Narcotics Anonymous. And it gives me pleasure to let Peter, who's kindly come along to introduce our speaker tonight. So, Peter, over to you.
Hi, my name is Peter Benedict.
Hello, Peter.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thanks for inviting me, Steve. I'd like to introduce Will, who I've known for quite a few years now, and I have actually enjoyed watching his recovery. So, Will, it's over to you.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks, Steve. Full disclosure, I've never done an audio-only share before, and I'm slightly freaking out a bit, but that's okay. If I'm sitting in my comfort zone, I'm not growing. And right now, doing this has helped me learn something about myself because I'll mention this more in my share, but I'm autistic, and I always say, and I thought I was telling the truth, that I don't like being able to see people, that I don't like body language, that I don't understand it and it freaks me out. But I've now realised, right now, today, for the first time in 43 years, that actually I do perceive body language a bit, and I do actually feed off of it and go back and forth with it, which I totally didn't think was true until 5 minutes ago. So thank you for giving me the chance to already, in the first minute of my share, learn something about myself. So start. Well, no, actually, I'm going to start with an anecdote about the first time I was freaking out doing public speaking. Because you know what? The first time I had to speak in public, it was a trade union meeting, and that doesn't really matter where it was, but I was so terrified that I had to go and get absolutely wasted on my own, and in order to stand up and speak. And then when I got there, I couldn't cover that I was wasted, and I lied about it, and I said, "Oh, a friend waylaid me, and we went to the pub," and proceeded to give my speech on that basis. But of course, I'd got wasted on my own just so I could speak in public. And you know what? I'm so grateful that it's not like that today, that I can be a bit afraid and still turn up, be present, and do these things. So now we'll get back to the beginning, which I mention this near the beginning, not to cut me off, but just to give not to cut me off from the fellowship, but just to give context. I'm autistic. I also identify as non-binary. You know what? I didn't know any of these things about myself as a kid. I was born in the 70s and grew up in the 80s and 90s. And then, everyone thought autistic was like Rain Man, whereas, I'm much more autistic like Courtney Love than like Rain Man. And non-binary, we didn't realise there were options other than male and female when I was growing up. So, every time someone, I went through. I don't want to be dramatic and say hell, but I went through a lot of misery at school with being bullied by other students, occasionally being bullied by teachers. And I grew up in a household where my dad drank, and sometimes he bullied me as well. I grew up, but the beginning of my story really is fear. Like, it wasn't there when I was a very little kid. When I was a very little kid, I was quite a happy little kid, just playing with my teddy bear and going on random adventures. But, by the time I was approaching adulthood, my life was defined by fear, was defined by feeling cut off and different from everyone else. You know what? By that point, like, the scariest day I remember at school was the one time one of the teachers, who was a bit sharp, actually took me aside, and he actually said, "You're not all right, are you, mate? You've got problems. You're living in your head." And you know what? I could not wait to get out of that room. I just put a wall up and said, no, no, I'm fine, I'm fine, even though I knew I was absolutely in misery, that I wanted to scream all the time, that, you know, I would rather be anyone other than me. But, like, being called on that, having someone recognise it, even someone kind like that who wanted to help, was the most terrifying thing that could have possibly happened. So, you know, by the time I hit 17, I was just full of this fear. Like, you know, I would go to school and, you know, most days I wouldn't get bullied by my dad or by other kids or by a teacher. Most days I would just hide in the background, putting on this mask of not conformity, but mask of introversion, mask of being like not connected to anyone or everything, just being, don't notice me, don't notice me. It's, and, you know, whilst at the same time desperately wanting to be noticed, desperately wishing I could be like all those other kids, wishing I could be, you know, normal. You know, I remember what my life was like the first time I ever picked up. It was that I've just said. You know, I wanted to scream all the time. So, you know, it's not like I picked up, my life was fantastic and I picked up and it went to crap. Before the first time I ever picked up, I wanted to scream all the time. I didn't exactly want to die, but I didn't really want to live either. I just wanted to scream because, you know, most days are all right, but I lived in the day where it wasn't all right. If 300 days were all right and one of them was terrible, I was living in the one terrible day all the time and all I wanted to do was scream. And, you know, when I first picked up, probably a common experience in the rooms, but, you know, I thought, blimmin' hell, this is phenomenal. This is the solution to everything. For the first time I can remember, I feel all right. I feel, you know, okay. And, you know, I never used normally. I never used normally. Like, I picked up. The next weekend I used four times as much. The weekend after that I used more. And a few months later, I was sitting alone in the snow on a swing in Canterbury in January, thinking like, all right, mate, this is a bit weird, isn't it? This is a bit weird. You might have a bit of a problem here. But, you know, my thought process was, I thought to myself, am I hurting anyone? Well, I might be hurting myself, I thought. But I thought, I have got moral permission to hurt myself. I own myself and I can hurt myself if I like. And, you know, this carried on for years. Soon after that, I went to university. And, you know, I loved university because I could camouflage. Students tend to drink a lot, and plenty of them use other things besides. And, you know, I could camouflage. I could go out drinking with my mate who everyone said was an alcoholic, and I could enjoy it. And I could think, like, he can keep up with me. So this is great, but I'm all right. I don't have a problem. And, you know, that carried on. I dropped out of university twice. You know, for years I carried on using. There were consequences quite early on. I suffered, I don't want to go into great detail of this, but I was sexually assaulted soon after university as a result of being too fucked for my own will to stop it happening, basically. You know what? That assault, along with the bullying that I suffered at school, I picked that up and I told no one, and I treasured it somewhere deep inside because it was, well, now I've got an excuse, haven't I? Now, it doesn't matter. I've got an excuse. I can say, you'd use too. I wasn't aware that this was the process going on. Wasn't aware until I came into recovery that this was the process going on, but it was. And you know what? I spent a lot of years using in, you could almost call it what seemed to be externally, it seemed to be a manageable fashion. For about 15 years, I was a workaholic during the week. I was a using addict at the weekend, basically. I'd work 40, sometimes 50 hours a week in my job, sitting there thinking every hour that ticked over, all right, you've paid for a bit more now. And at the weekend, I would have raves alone at home in my underpants, basically. And I'd be sitting there thinking, all right, other people are going out, getting loved up, making connections, having a life. You're sitting here raving alone in your underpants. That's a bit weird, isn't it, mate? It's a bit weird, but you're only hurting yourself. What I didn't know then, and what I'm actually hugely grateful for today, was that this disease is progressive. Because, if it had stayed like that, working like crazy during the week and raving in my pants at the weekend, if that had been the status quo, one day I would have woken up and I would have been 80. And that would have been all I'd ever done with my life, because the consequences were not severe enough to make me even think about changing at that point. I sort of knew I was wasting my life, but I didn't care. I didn't really, I didn't care about me much. But the last few years of my using were very different. I had a day, it's the darndest thing. I had a day where I ate a can of bad sardines, basically. I was up all night feeling ill from eating this can of bad sardines. I woke up in the morning and I was too ill to go to work. And I thought, like, I don't want to call in sick. And I thought, what's the solution to that? And I thought, well, what have you got lying around that will make you able to go into work? And from that day on, the progress of my disease, which had been glacial up to that point, it had been so slow that it was imperceptible to me. Suddenly, it went from being a snail or a tortoise to being a hare. Suddenly, the progress of my disease kicked into high gear. Pretty much instantly from that day, I was using something every single day. And you know what? For several years, when I was in the end of my active addiction, the way I told that story was that a can of bad sardines ruined my life. I absolutely and totally believed that it was the can of sardines that was the problem. That in an alternate universe where I didn't eat that can of sardines, I was getting along just fine. That's the level of my delusion. From there, within a few months, I was using all the drugs I said I'd never use. I'd fucked off the job on sick, and And I was camouflaging because I was hanging out with injecting sex workers, basically. And I was telling myself, well, but they're injecting a cocktail of drugs every 6 hours. You're just smoking a bit of this or that. You're probably all right, really. Probably. You're not too bad. But obviously I was too bad because, I don't know if I wanted to die. I don't think I did want to die because if I'd actually wanted to die, I would have made that happen. I kind of half accepted that I would die. It was like, okay, when it's time, the universe will just take me out and, you know, that'll be what will happen, fine, whatever. And, you know, but the universe was quite stubborn about not taking me out. And, you know, for that last 4 years of my using, I tried everything I could think of to use successfully. You know, I'd go off work sick, I'd go back to work, I'd hang out with this person instead of that person, I'd try taking this drug instead of that drug, you know, all the whatevers, you know, none of it seemed to work. None of it seemed to work. I could like almost get it together for a few weeks, even a couple of months here and there. But in the end, I'd just end up back where I was, off work, sick. You know, there were overdoses. There were times where I had to be brought round from going over, and I just used again afterwards. As soon as the paramedics left, I'd be like, well, what did you even do that for? I was really high. You've ruined it. And again, that just seemed a little bit weird. It didn't seem like literal insanity. And, you know, at the end of trying everything I could think of, or almost at the end, I did a detox off of my biggest physical dependency, which was benzos with the doctors. And, you know, at the end of that, I thought, okay, you're all right now. You've been reset. It's all fine. You can go back to just using like you did in 2000 when you could kind of sort of use successfully. It'll be completely and totally fine. And, you know, spoiler warning, it wasn't fine. What happened was in the last few months of 2016, I repeated the whole progress that had taken years the first time through all the different drugs in the space of about 3 months. And actually, rewind, because I missed something relevant. Weirdest thing, and one of the signs that I know there's a higher power looking after me, around the same time in 2016, I read a comic book about the comic book character Loki, which is, you know, it's significant because, you know, he was trying to escape from all his dark past and his misdeeds and trying to change and be better. And you know what? That comic book, I read it, the whole thing, overnight. And that was when I started to think I could be better, that I want to be better. And I just randomly read that comic book. And it gave me the first bit of hope I'd ever had. Not enough hope to actually do anything or change anything. But, you know, it gave me a bit of hope. I've still got to write a bloody letter to the writer thanking him for that. It's been several years, but I'll put it back on my to-do list now. But, you know, anyway, 2016, you know, by the end of 2016, by the very beginning of 2017, I'd repeated the whole thing over again in a few months, and what happened was I used heroin every day for a week at the beginning of 2017. It wasn't my rock bottom. I'd been in much lower, much more horrible places than I was that week, but you know what, that scared the crap out of me, because at that point I knew how bad it was about to get. I knew how bad it was going to be in a week or 2 weeks' time, and I was scared out of my mind. I still wasn't scared enough to just stop taking drugs, but I was really scared. And I did the first sensible, kind thing I had done for myself in maybe two decades. And again, this is a higher power moment. I had a load of random Facebook friends who I didn't know from Adam, because I used to randomly send out Facebook friend requests. One of them, though, they were open about being in recovery. They never mentioned NA on their public profile, anonymity and all that, but they were open about being in recovery. In my fear, when I was thinking, what can I do? I just private messaged them and said, help, I'm in trouble. What do I do? And this amazing person who I'd never met at that point, I'd never even spoken to them. I just knew them as a Facebook associate. They spent weeks over Facebook Messenger, 12-stepping me into this fellowship, convincing me to get to a meeting. And you know what? That person, every time I get a keyring now, they get a Facebook Messenger copy of that keyring, because, you know, without them, I don't know where I'd be. You know what? After that several weeks of furious messengering, I finally agreed to go to an NA meeting. I went into a NA meeting in Folkestone. I was listening very much for the difficulties, and not difficulties, the differences, not the similarities at this meeting. I didn't get much of a message at that meeting. I wasn't even clean. And, you know, it was only four people, including me, and the other three all had significant recovery. And, you know, all I heard at that meeting, they might well have shared an NA message. They might well have shared loads about my problem. But all I heard at that meeting was them sharing about their problems with shoes and video games and all that stuff. And you know what? I was thinking, what on earth is all this about? I've got a terrifying drug problem, although I'm just going to do a time jump here and say a lot of those people were at my 1 year clean celebration where I mentioned my problem with shoes, and they all wiggled their feet at me in recognition and identification. So I got to the point where I got that, but and I'm so grateful. But you know, on that day I wasn't hearing that, but you know, I was all out of ideas. And it's fair to say that one of my defining characteristics, even before that point, even before I went to NA, was that I would try at least anything twice. So I went back to another NA meeting in the same place the next night. You know, I don't remember a word that was said at that one, but it was full of people who were struggling, people who were not clean or who were only a few days clean, and one person celebrating a year clean. You know what? That meeting, I don't remember a word that was said, but I stepped out thinking I can do this. I stepped out believing that there was some possibility that this might work for me. Although I still didn't get clean, because, you know, I was still full of that defining arrogance and self-centeredness. And when they said do 90 meetings in 90 days, I thought, yeah, right, get lost. I've got a job. I've got a relationship. I'm going to do one meeting a week, maybe two if I'm feeling virtuous. I'm not going to follow anything else. I'm just going to turn up occasionally. But you know what? I'm basically cured as a result of having been to two meetings and basically having heard a few things that I identified with. You know, I had this glorious plan. I'll still go and see my friend who I use with every weekend at the weekend. I just won't use. That'll totally work. And, you know, spoiler alert again, that didn't work. And I wasn't cured. And, you know, I spent about 5 months bouncing back and forth. And you know what? Over that five months, I ended up off sick work from work again. The relationship went away. And, you know, the dodgy doctor who used to prescribe me things that I shouldn't be prescribed also disappeared. And, you know, I didn't put any of these things aside. I want to be quite clear on that. It would have been better and more spiritually well if I'd just made a choice, maybe. But I didn't. Higher power took those barriers that were in the way of me getting well. So, you know, during that 5 months, I did a little diversion to another fellowship, which I won't go into in any great depth because they're an outside issue. But, You know, funny thing, when I did that little diversion, I found that the problem was still in the room I was sitting in. Somehow, quite coincidentally, I found that the problem had come with me. So, I did have a sponsor briefly in that other fellowship, and you know, they were telling me I wasn't getting step one, which is a fair shout. I don't think I ever could have got it in that other fellowship. So, I came up with another one of the very rare good ideas that I was having, and I knew I needed to be in NA. Now, I didn't handle that like an adult. I didn't have the capacity to. I got into an argument and dumped my sponsor in that other fellowship. And yes, they are now still on my amends list. But what I did was, around that time, I was going for coffee with various people from NA, mostly after the meeting in Whitstable, the lunchtime meeting. We were going for coffee in Whitstable, and they were all talking about this thing called the Step Working Guide and the questions. I was intrigued by this. I was fascinated by this. So, you know, and it's not suggested that you do this. It's suggested that you crack the Step Working Guide open once you've got a sponsor. But honestly, what I did was I didn't start answering the questions, but I absolutely did get a copy of the Step Working Guide and I started reading those questions for step one. And, you know, reading them, I could feel higher power coming off of those questions. I could feel that they were going to help me if I worked them with a sponsor. And you know what? I got a sponsor in NA. I didn't actually start answering them till I had a sponsor. And you know what? They did help me. Because, you know, I worked step one in this fellowship. And you know what my life was before I worked step one? For years, I had felt this ticking clock in my head, ticking down to the next time I used. I didn't know exactly when the alarm was going to go off, but I knew it was tick, 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 ticking all the time. And I knew when it ticked down and it went off, I would be on the corner, not knowing whether I was more afraid that the dealer wasn't going to turn up, or that they were. And you know what? After I worked step one, that clock went away. That clock wasn't there anymore. And you know what? Answering all those questions from step one, like, you know, there's a lot more ways you can look at them, because you can look at them like step one, the actual text of step one doesn't mention drugs. Not once. It just mentions addiction. So, you know, there's lots of other ways my addiction can come out. But I was about 25 days clean, give or take. It took me more than a day to answer all of them. Not much more, but more than a day. So about 25 days clean. So I was reading all of those questions as, can you use drugs successfully? What happens when you use drugs? What are the consequences when you use drugs? Asked at me 69 different ways. And you know what? It turned out that the answer, resoundingly, is that every time I use drugs, it hurts more than it feels good. Every time I use drugs, it fucks up my life. Every time I use drugs, it ends up with me being miserable, alone and broken. You know what? Fundamentally, deep down in my core, in the pit of my being, I'm a hedonist. I love pleasure. I hate pain. And if I know, not just suspect as I did before, not just suspect, if I know from that understanding of having worked step one around drug use, that it's always going to hurt more than it feels good if I use, then what that does is it's a psychic transformation, and I'm gesticulating wildly here and you can't see it, but it's a psychic transformation. It flips me on my head. And what that does is it means that where my default for 22 years had been to use drugs, once I've worked step one, my default is not to use drugs. And this is an opinion, and they're like arseholes, but I'm of the opinion that I could force myself to use drugs having worked step one, but it would be a conscious act of self-will. I would have to fight myself to pick up drugs after having worked step one, whereas before I was always having to fight myself not to pick up drugs, and I always lost. So with step one, I've not found it necessary to use drugs ever since that point. I've only really wanted to use twice since that point in my life, both of them in the first year, because the obsession quietened down, but it didn't completely go away after working step one. And you know, both of those times that I've sat in the obsession and compulsion, used drugs in my first year, I was climbing the walls, resenting that step one, thinking like, if I didn't know what it was going to cost, if I didn't absolutely know that the price isn't worth paying, I could treat it like a credit card and worry about the price later. So, you know, while I was in it, I absolutely resented that step one. I climbed the walls thinking like, why are you stopping me? But it stopped me anyway. Afterwards, I was immensely grateful for that. However, it's a 12-step program, not a one-step program. I might stay clean off drugs for a very long time on a one-step program. I might stay clean off drugs for weeks or months. I might even stay that way till I die. However, I mentioned earlier on, the day before I picked up, my life wasn't exactly kittens, rainbows and roses. My life was hell. My life was that living, eternal, silent scream before the day I picked up. And you know what? Step one isn't the solution to anything except the using drugs. Step one is just the reset. Step one takes me back to the day before I picked up drugs. But luckily, there's another 12 steps for the rest of it to start to address everything else. And you know, I'm not going to run through all 12 of them because, frankly, I'm not as eloquent explaining all of the others as I am with step one. But you know, step two, like, you know, I did the writing for step two, and at first it didn't really penetrate. At first I did the writing for step two and step three and passed over them with a relative minimum of fuss, thinking, yeah, I get it. And you know, that took me to that point at 9 months clean, which was the last time I've sat in obsession and compulsion to use. 9 months clean, that was when I was climbing the walls, wanting to use, desperate to use. And you know, by this point, I was picking up a bunch of service and I had friends in NA. I bloody loved recovery. And my thought process at that point was, I love recovery. It's brilliant. If I use, it'll be shit and it'll fuck everything in recovery up. But I want to do it anyway. And I'm obsessed with doing it anyway. And you know what happened? I went to a step two meeting. I wasn't going to go to this meeting, but I randomly went to it. It was all about step two. And you know, that shone a ray of light because I was unaware of the insanity of that thought process of wanting to use, even though I knew it would fuck everything up. I was blissfully unaware of it. I was sitting that same way of sitting in insanity, the same as when I was sitting in the swing on the swings using, the same as when I was raving at home using, the same as when I used directly after an overdose. I was sitting in that same insanity, and you know, I went to that step two meeting. I did some more work around step two. I did work with doctors and counsellors for my mental health because I do have mental health issues. And you know what? I wouldn't say I've been restored to sanity from that point because I can still be insane around literally anything that isn't narcotic drugs. I'm relatively sane compared to where I was when I came into these rooms, and relatively sane compared to that madness at 9 months clean. So, I continued working the steps, but I'm going to branch off into sort of talking about in my remaining 6 minutes into a few of the challenges I've faced in recovery. You know what? And I'm going to say something about something that's helped me. I've always done service. Service has always helped to keep me clean. And I've always turned up for group service and bit of area service, and I've just totally gone off on a tangent there, and I wasn't planning that. So back to where I was. I don't know now. Yeah. So first year clean. I wouldn't say I had any major challenges. My challenge was staying clean. So I was really fortunate. Work gave me a payout for sacking me, which that my side of the street wasn't clean, neither was theirs, and we just agreed, oh, do you want a year's pay to piss off, basically. So I was lucky to get to do recovery full time for my first year clean, which thank you, higher power, for that one. So first year clean, I just did recovery full time. I did service, I went to meetings, I shared, I had a sponsor, I worked the steps, and everything was diggity boo. And but at the end of that first year clean, life started happening to a degree. Life still doesn't happen a great deal to me. I mostly keep myself to myself and work the program and go to work, and I don't do much else. But when the first year was up, things started happening. The first big challenge I faced in recovery was when the DWP found me fit for work. You know what? I had a complete self-centered meltdown over that. I was like, how dare you? How dare you? I'm doing recovery full time, and you should pay me to do that for the rest of my life. I had a meltdown. I spoke to my sponsor, carried on having a meltdown for a bit more, paid someone 80 quid to appeal the judgment for me, in a typical show of insanity. And then finally, after I'd done all of these things, I did inventory around it and looked at what they'd actually said about me. And what they'd said was, you're fit for work. When I did inventory around it, I was like, motherfucker, it's true, isn't it? You are fit for work. Once I realized that, it was okay. I guess I better look for a job. And I wasn't quite ready for paid work. I found voluntary work. And again, higher power kind of got involved, because I was an admin in my job I did when I was in active addiction, and I've got some mad skills around adminning. And I thought, like, I want to use those skills for good, was what I thought. And I just Googled mental health admin volunteering, I think was what I Googled. I can't remember. I might not even have put the word admin in. I don't know. No, I don't know. But I Googled something around mental health volunteering, and the first job that came up, literally the first result, was volunteer admin for the drug services in a town about 30 miles away, a nice easy train journey away from me, away from the people I used with, but local. And admin, I thought of myself as a god of admin work. Admin helping people who haven't quite found recovery yet. And I thought that if that's the first Google result that comes up, power's probably telling me something. And I went for it, and I volunteered for a year, and I loved it. And I thought, like, but then I was getting to the point where I had to get paid work, because I'd run out of that that payout. I'd made a year's pay last 2 years, and that included paying off my drug debts. But, you know, got to the point where I needed paid employment. Then a paid job came up, doing the job I'd been doing for free. And, you know, I got it. And now that's where I am. And, you know, the paid job is in my town. The paid job, I'm sitting behind reception in drug services, manning the reception and doing the admin work in the drug services where I used to go as a client, where people I used to use with come in as clients. And you know what? I love that. There's lots of things I hate about it as well. On another day, I could complain about work for 40 minutes in another context, certainly. But you know what? Getting to sit behind reception doing my work, and having people I use with come in, I bleed in love it because, you know, I'm all about efficiency. And if I can carry a message that recovery is possible, that you can get from where I was and where some people still are to like working for drug services without even having to say a word while just sitting there on my computer while people wait in the waiting room, then, you know, I love that because it's efficiency. It's the strongest possible message for the least possible effort. And, you know, I haven't been relieved of the defect that makes me rather like getting the most result for the least effort. And, you know, another challenge I came up with, you know, just outside of my first year clean, was like, you know, I've only had one big death in recovery, which was like, you know, my best friend, sort of partner, who I used a lot with. And, you know, but she was a real best friend. And, you know, that was painful. And it was 3 years ago now. And to be honest, I still haven't fully processed it. There's still pain there. But, you know, I didn't want to use it. I wouldn't say it didn't occur to me to use, but there was only the briefest junk thought, which I didn't give any credence because I knew that if I used, it would just make it worse. And I knew that if I used, it would be the most selfish thing I could possibly do, because it would be about making my friend's death about me. And so I was able to hold it together to arrange accommodation and transport to go down to Cornwall for the funeral. And again, this is part of the reason I share this. It's the weirdest thing. The funeral was in the same part of the world as the person who 12-stepped me into the fellowship over Facebook Messenger. So, you know, I messaged them just to ask about the area, just to ask for advice how to get there, because it was on a bleeding peninsula and I had no idea. And I just thought, few local tips. And it's the weirdest thing. The funeral was in a graveyard that was only yards from the door of the person that 12-stepped me into this fellowship. So, you know, I don't know if I'd have felt safe going to that funeral without some recovery down there. But, you know, I went to the funeral and then I went and I actually met the person who 12-stepped me into this fellowship. I don't know what that means, but I could hazard a guess that it means there's some sort of higher power that's looking after me. So, you know, I say I've still got emotional processing to do around that. You know, at least I was present. At least I was able to be there. And, you know, I was told by my friend's sister that my clean date was almost the only entry in my friend's diary, which, again, I don't know what I feel about that. Overwhelmingly sad, but also, I don't know, complex things, I don't know. But I'm really glad that my friend's sister told me. You know, what other challenges have I faced? Well, you know, I spent my second and third year struggling with my weight, and my blood pressure. You know, it came to a point at about 2.5 years clean where I was overeating to the point where at one point I crapped myself in public. I was having migraines that they didn't make me want to use, but they made me want to die. If I'd had a gun, I would have blown my head off, I think, because there's just so much pain. I went to the I went to the doctor. I went to the doctor, and they said, "Well, you're pretty overweight and you smoke a lot." And up until that point, there's a bit in our literature where it says, "Do you agree that it would be insane to ask for a stroke or a heart attack?" And every time I read that bit in our literature, I kind of side-eyed my cigarettes and my can of sweetened condensed milk, and I thought, "Yeah, I'm not getting rid of you. Love you." But after it turned out that I had this problem with blood pressure that was giving me migraines that were killing me, well, weren't killing me, but were making me want to die, they'd taken me back to another rock bottom clean. I started thinking, well, I didn't immediately start thinking I need some sanity around this. At first, I did exactly the same as I did with the drugs. I tried to half-arse it. I put myself, got some outside help from the NHS, and I did 2 weeks of watching what I eat and writing it all down and weighing myself. And I put on weight during those 2 weeks. I literally put on weight during those first 2 weeks of half-arsing it. The next thing I tried was I spoke to my higher power. I don't call it praying when I speak to my higher power, but I spoke to my higher power. The first thing I asked was, I said to my higher power, "You're a deity. You're omnipotent. You can make me thin." And my higher power doesn't often directly speak to me in words, but in this instance it did. And it said, "Yeah, I could. I'm omnipotent. I can do anything I like. But I'm not going to just make you thin, because if I do, you'll just make yourself overweight again straight away. You won't value it. I'm not doing anything for you by magic, mate." I took action. I took action. I lost most of the weight. I still vape like a maniac, but I'm working on that. I've had the odd relapse on cigarettes, but I mostly just vape now. I've improved it. My blood pressure is sorted out. I'm not getting the migraines. So, I've been restored to a bit of sanity on that. Not fully restored to sanity. I don't have the level of step one around eating, around cigarettes, around any other form of acting out that I have around drugs. I can be good on every other form of acting out on a good day, but the moment I'm having a bad day, I start my restoration to sanity around all the forms of acting out tends to start going out the window a bit, but it's not as bad as it was 2 years ago. There's been progress, but there isn't perfection in the area of acting out. So I've been going for well over 40 minutes. I'm just going to finish on a little tale I love to finish on. Apologies if you've heard this one before. I don't know how many people I know are in here. But a couple of years ago, I felt lonely. I felt like I wanted a partner. I felt really sort of lonely in recovery. It's not suggested you do this, but I prayed for something for myself. The level of spiritual wellness I was able to apply was, I didn't say to my higher power, "Give me a girlfriend." What I said to my higher power was, "Give me as much love as you think I can handle." I was like saying what I wanted in broad terms, but then I handed it over to my higher power to fill in the details, which was as well as I was capable of being on that day. And you know what? After I said this prayer, this little cat, this little injured, stray, starved, grey cat came walking in the door and pretty much announced, "I live with you now." I didn't have any choice in this matter. The cat decided he lived with me now. And, you know, that cat came in, and that cat was as much love as I could handle. That cat is illustrating to me that I'm definitely not ready for a relationship with a human being, because every time he's out of sight for more than an hour or so, I'm completely freaking out. And I have regular meltdowns relating to my relationship with the cat. And, you know, in other ways, the cat acts like one of us. He disappears for days, he gorges himself on pleasure, and he gives no craps for me or anyone else unless he happens to want something. The cat is teaching me about my previous behaviour, and the cat is as much love as I can handle, and my prayer was were granted, but not in the way that I imagined. You know, my experience has been that higher power sorts me out, that things work out, that I stay clean, and that I don't always get what I want, but I get what I need, and that things are basically all right. And, you know, I'm now sitting here with a little more than 4 years recovery from using drugs. I'm not sitting here with a cat right now because he's outside, as he often is, but I'm sitting here with a cat in that I'm connected to him. So, yeah, I'm sitting here with a job in the field, with a cat, with 4 years recovery. So I'm going to wind up and say thank you all. Thank you for being part of my recovery, and thank you, NA. Thank you.